This podcast is brought to you by BrunnerAcademy.com, your online resource for the best public speaking, presentation, storytelling skills courses. Become a rockstar communicator in any setting. Visit BrunnerAcademy.com.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Live Your Best Life with Liz Brunner. I'm Liz, and my goal with each episode is to share stories of people who are recreating their lives or rising above challenges to write their next chapters with authenticity. These stories give me the courage to go after living my best life, and I think they will do that for you too. If you like this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to the show, so this podcast can continue to inspire next chapters all over the world. My guest today is a winemaker, an F-16 fighter pilot, and a successful business entrepreneur. And that's just the short list of his accomplishments. How'd he do all of it? We're about to find out. Today, he's taking all of those experiences and helping others discover how not to only live their best life, but to do it at peak performance. Anthony Bork, welcome to my podcast, or should I call you AB today?
You can call me AB or Anthony Burke, either one. We joke, Liz, that my last name rhymes with jerk, not dork. That's one of our biggest challenges when I introduce myself. So now that we're better accomplished, it's really nice to be on your podcast.
Well, I appreciate you being here. And first of all, I must say thank you for your 20 years of service to this country with the Air Force. So appreciated. And we have a lot of veterans who listen, so they'll be happy to hear from you as well. Growing up, your family was immersed in the world of wine as investors, and you continued to follow that passion, ultimately making wine. But you also had another passion and lifelong dream to fly F-16s. Where did that dream come from?
That dream developed pretty early. I was very fortunate that my father was a Navy fighter pilot. He flew A-4 Skyhawks in the Navy, both on the active duty and the reserves out of Moffett Field, which is Mountain View, California. And he also became a United Airlines pilot. So I was around aviation quite a bit as a young boy and young man. And by about the age of 16, I had developed what I still to this day call the dream. And my dream was to be a 35-year-old F-16 pilot in the reserves, United Airlines captain based out of San Francisco, and a bachelor. I thought that would be the ultimate life. You know, you got to have a plan. At age 27, I was flying F-4 Phantoms out of McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey, on the active duty. I got married. I had my first child, and the airlines wouldn't hire me. Plans don't always go exactly as you want, but in the end, it all turned out just great, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
It sure did. But somewhere along the way, before your flying days, you were winemaking, and you took a hiatus from making wine, and that's when you joined the Air Force. And you were a highly decorated F-16 fighter pilot. You flew many tactical missions all over the world. I think you accumulated something like 2,700 hours of flight time and numerous performance aircraft you just mentioned a few a moment ago. How does it feel to hop into the cockpit, pull the helmet over your ears, close the canopy, and take to the skies at more than 1,200 miles per hour?
Well, at least for me, since that was my life dream, it feels incredible. It feels like the achievement of your dream and then even more, because it's even better than you ever imagined. So flying F-16s is an incredibly powerful feeling. The airplane weighs about 27,000 pounds, fully loaded with fuel, and yet it can generate over 30,000 pounds of thrust. So that's a better than a one-to-one thrust ratio, which allows you to point straight up and keep accelerating. So it's really an incredible experience. And of course, that bubble canopy, you can see the whole world so clearly. With the technology in the F-16, all of your controls were really in your left hand, which was your throttle, and your right hand, which was a stick. And you just couldn't believe there were people smart enough to develop such a cool airplane and that you had the privilege of flying it. So better than expected.
Did you ever get sick or pass out? Because I can't even imagine what that gravity feels like against your body. Or were you just a natural at flying?
So get sick and pass out, two separate things. air sickness or motion sickness is something that I think you're either generally born with or not. I don't happen to get motion sick. So no, I've never gotten air sick. Pass out is a different one. The F-16 16 can pull 9 Gs, which is essentially 9 times the force of gravity. So right now you and I are both experiencing 1 times the force of gravity, which, you know, that's what's keeping us sitting in our chair. And under 1 times the force of gravity, I mean, think about it this way, your head weighs about 10 pounds. Of course, with 9 times the force of gravity, 9 Gs, now your 10-pound head weighs about 90 pounds, and it is harder to move, it's harder to think, it's harder to breathe. More importantly, those G-forces suck all of the blood out of your head and try to move them down to your feet. And when the blood leaves your head or your brain, oxygen leaves your head, your brain, and the first thing that happens to your vision is it starts to go away. If you don't overcome that by forcing the blood back up into your head, you can pass out. We call that affectionately taking a nap. I think the scientists call it G-lock, G-induced loss of consciousness. And unfortunately, there are some people that have taken a nap and not woken up in time.
How do you get the blood back up?
First of all, you wear a G-suit. Some people call them speed jeans, and now they're full body suits. When you pull G's, the G-suit squeezes your calves, your quads, your abdomen, and now there's a pressure breathing system that forces air into your mouth. That helps force the blood back into your head, but you also do something called an L1 maneuver in the Air Force. The Navy calls it a hook maneuver, where you're artificially trying to force that blood up into your head or increase your blood pressure. You can see on the video what it looks like. It also sounds kind of funny, but it's like this.
Okay.
And that's forcing that blood into your head, keeping your vision and keeping you conscious. So flying F-16s is hard work. Most people, when they come back, you talked about sickness. You don't feel sick, but you feel exhausted, completely wrung out, because it is such a physical game.
Ooh, my goodness. September 11th, 2001. Many people remember where they were that day of the terrorists' attacks. I was actually covering that story on television. You were a United Airlines passenger, I believe. You were on a flight, and you eventually found yourself becoming one of the first pilots to fly over New York City in the Homeland Defense efforts. How did that happen?
Yeah, amazing coincidental story. Morning of September 11, 2001, I was catching a 9:30 a.m. United Airlines flight out of Burlington, Vermont, the Burlington, Vermont International Airport. At that time, I was CEO and president of a company called Afterburner Seminars. I'd been working with a client up in Lake Placid, New York on September 10th, and I was flying the morning of the 11th on a 9:30 United flight because I was on my way to work with another client in Denver, Colorado. At that time, I was also an F-16 pilot with the 144th Fighter Wing of the California Air National Guard, based in beautiful Fresno, California, where I also lived, had a wife and 3 children. We were all on the airplane ready to go. There, we had a ground stop. We all got off. I walked out in the terminal and I saw on the television monitors exactly what you saw. And my first reaction was probably very similar to yours. I said, my gosh, how can I help? I figured out very quickly there was an F-16 squadron right on the other side of that field. That's the 134th Fighter Squadron, the Vermont Air National Guard. And so I picked up my cell phone and I called their squadron commander and I said, hey, sir, Major Anthony Burke, F-16 pilot, 144th Fighter Wing, California Air National Guard. Sir, I'm stuck here in Burlington, just saw what happened on the TV and was wondering if I could help. Very long silence on the other end of the phone. And he finally responded. He said, dude, what size boots do you wear? He said, I've just been tasked to fly Homeland Defense 24/7 over New York City. I need 12 pilots to do the mission. I've only got 11 here right now. Get over here as quick as you can. I can't do the mission without you. So needless to say, I hung up with him. I literally sprinted out to the curb, jumped in a taxi. We sped around the field. 10 minutes later, I came on a brand new base. And just a few hours later, then I found myself taking off in a jet that I'd never flown, flying with wingmen who I'd never met, flying in airspace that I'd never flown in. And yet I felt like I was flying that mission for the 100th time. And of course, that's a lot about what I talk about. You know, that's the power of the training and the standardization that we use, not just in the Air Force, but in the Army, in the Navy, in the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard, that you can plug and play people in the most challenging circumstances and get them up to speed and execute in a very high level. Mm-hmm. It's truly magical.
It really is. What was the scariest mission you ever flew and why?
Oh man, I think I've flown a few scary missions in my day. I had a wingman eject over Gene. He blacked out, and when he woke up, he was in full afterburner, passing 600 knots, about 45 degrees nose low, headed for the ground. And he perceived there was some rising terrain. He perceived that he was going to hit the ground, so he ejected. That was pretty scary. I mean, you know, your wingman suddenly ejects from an aircraft. We started a search and rescue operation. We were fortunate that he landed safely. The only real damage he had was he dislocated his elbow. Our tech manual says that if you eject at over 300 miles an hour, you will experience severe flailing, which he clearly did. But he spent a few hours in the desert before we could get a helicopter to pick him up. And when you have a wingman eject, your heart is all the way up in your throat and you just are thinking to yourself, my gosh, please be okay, please be okay, please be okay, which he fortunately was. But that's certainly up there with one of the scariest.
Are you still flying F-16s or in the reserves, or do you have a mandatory stop? Because I know in some pilot organizations you do, so I don't know about the Air Force with the F-16.
Certainly the airlines is stopping people from flying at 65. Yes. They say they're going to bump it up.
They're trying to change that. I know that.
The G environment is slightly lower in the airlines than in the F-16. It is, I would say, a young man and a young women's game.
Yeah.
You know, much like playing in the NFL. I mentioned how physical it can be. We do have pilots that are well over 40 and even in their 50s in the reserves. And what they maybe are giving up a little bit in physical stamina and ability, they gain so much because they're so experienced, and experience really goes a long way. I stopped flying when I turned 40. At that time, it was just the right time for me. I had a wife and three children. I was running the business I mentioned previously. I was even still trying to fly for the airlines. And I just had too many balls in the air. And in fact, the thing that pushed me over the edge was my 8-year-old son came in. At that time, I had a home office. He came into my office one day and he was standing in the office kind of up against the wall, kind of uncomfortable. And I looked at him. I said, "Hey, Liam, how you doing?" He said, "Fine." And he said, "Dad, when I get big, I'm never going on any trips." And I said, "Wow." So that was like a lightning bolt hit me right in the head.
Yeah.
And I made some pretty significant changes at that point. I stopped flying for the airlines. I stopped flying for the reserves. I focused all my time on my business and my family. And that just gave me a lot more balance in my life.
Yeah.
And worked out pretty well because he turned out just fine.
Well, that's good. And you mentioned some of your other businesses. I know you were a top producing mortgage broker. You took a startup company from $500,000 to $65 million. You had a global management training company. You mentioned it before with the two other fighter pilots. And now you're the CEO and founder of Mach 2 Consulting, where your mission today is to help business leaders operate at peak performance by introducing them to similar skills between being a fighter pilot and a business leader. And you talked about a moment ago about exchanging skill sets here. Connect the dots for us, Anthony.
Well, it's amazing how many dots connect in this field. I think people always say to me, geez, AB, of course you prepare and train and execute at the highest possible level as a fighter pilot. I mean, geez, if you repeat mistakes, you could lose your life. I mean, we don't have that same situation in my business. And I look at them and I say, well, that's interesting you say that, because at least in my experience, when businesses repeat mistakes, when they become complacent, when they stop focusing on growing their people, they may not lose their lives, but you can certainly lose your way of life. We know businesses go away. We know people lose their jobs, sell their homes, move someplace else. I would certainly say that the stakes of not executing at the highest level, at not achieving peak performance, at not staying number one in your space, can be nearly as significant as they can for a fighter pilot. Every business I've been involved in running, I started to realize we ran the same way we ran our fighter squadrons. Mm. And, you know, that provided structure, it provided discipline, and it also provided a culture of open and honest feedback that we call debrief in the military.
Yeah.
Finding a way to call time out at the end of the day, at the end of the week, at the end of the mission, and say, what worked, what didn't, and how can we do things just a little bit better tomorrow? So driving this culture of continuous improvement. And in my opinion, companies that embrace an open, honest culture of feedback and are constantly looking to get better are the ones that win instead of just kind of compete.
I loved you calling that debrief the sacred learning environment. And I think that's so true. But you also add that briefing is not planning. Briefing is not planning. Can you give us a snippet of what you mean by that?
I talk a lot about a model that I call the feedback loop of regular briefing and debriefing. And so when we talk about briefing, fighter pilots say, you may be the best and the brightest fighter pilot in the world. You know, you could have the greatest ideas or plans or tactics in your head. But if you haven't found a way to communicate those great plans, those great ideas, the people are going to be flying with you. Mm-hmm. Or of course, in the world of business, the people who are either working for you or with you, then all of your ideas will be for naught because you'll be flying solo and so will your wingman. Yeah. And that's why when fighter pilots get ready to fly any kind of mission, whether it's a one-hour training mission or a six-hour combat mission, even though we've been preparing for hours for our missions, or just like in business, in so many cases, we've been preparing for days or even weeks for our missions, just before we get ready to take off, or maybe better put in the language of business, just before we get ready to execute our day, our week, our key customer meetings and events, fighter pilots always sit down and hold a briefing to ensure that when we walk out the door, jump in our cockpits, put on our helmets, and start engines, that we are going to be aligned, that we're going to be flying in formation, that we're going to execute at the highest possible level. And I think in most businesses, that the mission is going to be safe. So I love talking to the business world about the power of briefing, how fighter pilots use it to drive better results and keep the team aligned and flying in formation, and show business people how they can use those same simple tools to accomplish the same tools in their business.
I was struck by something I heard you say, which was no fighter pilot has ever flown the perfect mission. Really? Yeah. That sounds so scary.
Well, I don't think you'll ever meet a fighter pilot that would argue that point. You know, one of the great qualities that tactical aviation brings to all of us, no matter how big egos are, is humility and recognizing that no fighter pilot has ever flown the perfect mission and that we can always get just a little bit better. And so that's where this idea of debrief comes from. You know, we call time out at the end of every mission, go into a room, close the door, and talk about what worked, what didn't, and how we can do things just a little bit better tomorrow. Yeah. Something magical happens. When that door closes, name tags come off our chest. They're literally Velcroed on our flight suit. So we rip them off and we throw them down on the table. Rank comes off our shoulders and we hold a debrief where there is no hierarchy and the sole purpose is to learn and get to get better. Now, many people would look at me and say, geez, AB, that sounds cool in your fighter squadron, but I don't know if I feel too good about that. That's a little radical for my business. I don't want to embarrass the general like that. I certainly don't want to make the second lieutenant, the new hire, uncomfortable. And I agree with him. I understand it is uncomfortable, but I'll make the point. Let's talk about the master arm switch in an F-16.
Yeah.
With a master arm switch in the armed position, if our general were to hit the red pickle button on top of his stick, bombs could come off the bottom of the airplane. Huge explosion. Or if that general got a little trigger happy, as he's been known to do, and pulls that red trigger on the stick, bullets can come out the front of the airplane. And this is not a pea shooter. This is a 20 millimeter Vulcan cannon. It can shoot 6,000 rounds a minute or 100 bullets a second. You know, our general can take you out at 2 miles with this weapon. It's highly effective. So the last thing I want to do right now is sweep my generals, number twos, deviation from our standards that we know keep us safe and make us great under the rug and allow him to fly again next week in a combat environment. I mean, to me, that feels much more radical.
Yeah.
Maybe more importantly, because it's unlikely the general will fly in combat next week. He or she has been there and done that. They've earned their stripes. But what about my second lieutenant at the other end of the table?
Right.
Don't you think we owe it to them to accelerate their experience as rapidly as possible? Or are we from this old school that says, hey, new guy, new gal, you know, just work hard, smile, and everything will work itself out? No, we have to accelerate their experience, especially with the pace of change and the level of competition we're all experiencing in the business world today. So I personally believe that we have to debrief if we're going to continue to grow our people and grow our business.
In the midst of sharing all of this knowledge, experience, and expertise with leaders, you're still very active in the California wine industry. You serve on a number of boards, and you have your own boutique winery called Mary Hale Wine. What kinds of wines do you make, and what do you love about winemaking?
Our winery is called Hail Mary, and it is
Hail Mary.
H-A-L-E-M-A-R-Y, named after my wife, Mary Burke, who is a 25-year breast cancer survivor. So we say hail and hearty Mary Burke, and hail to all people fighting this terrible disease. We make Russian River Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Looks like that's something you like as well.
Yep, I'm a Pinot girl, a Pinot Noir girl.
you're my kind of girl. We need to get together. The Russian River, as you know, is about an hour north of San Francisco in one of the most beautiful parts of California, which is just climatically perfect for growing and producing great Pinot Noir. Cool climate, fog rolling in every night, which really provides us great acid in our grapes. Pinot Noir is my favorite grape. And so Hail Mary only makes wine from the Russian River. That is my passion. You know, we make about 1,000 cases of wine a year. I've been doing it for 20 years. We sell most of the wine through a mailing list, and then the rest we sell through our favorite restaurants.
All right. I have to find out if you can mail to Massachusetts.
Oh, yes, we do that quite often.
Oh, excellent. Anthony, you've had so many chapters, many accomplishments. What has surprised you most about your career journey?
I think the biggest surprises for me is just when you think you've got it all figured out, you get thrown a curveball. If you can't adapt to curveballs, you're probably not going to have the career you dreamed of. You know, this idea of, and people see this all the time with CEOs, and you think, oh my gosh, they've had such a storied career. And they have. But every single one will tell you the same thing. Let me tell you about the 10 things I screwed up. Let me tell you the 10 times I got unlucky. Let me tell you the 10 bad things that happened to me and how I dealt with it. Mm-hmm. So it's not what happens to you. It's what you do about it. I don't think anyone is ever going to have just a perfect straight line rise to the top or rise to a place of professional satisfaction. So I think the ability to roll with the punches, to see change coming and embrace it when it does, is critical.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
If you would like to learn more about Anthony, his website is Mach 2 Consulting, and we'll have that link for you in our show notes. Anthony, I often share with audiences a quote from my grandmother, which is, no knowledge is ever wasted. And you are certainly living proof of that by taking all of your experience and using them to create not only next chapters, but now you're sharing that knowledge with the world. And I thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been fun.
It has really been a pleasure. Really nice to meet you, Liz. And I hope our paths will cross again over a glass of Pinot Noir.
That sounds perfect to me. And thanks to all of you for tuning in today. May Anthony's story inspire you to go after your dreams and passions and live your best life. Until next time, be well.
This podcast is brought to you in part by Fast Twitch Media, helping people tell their stories and giving them worldwide reach. The future is in the cloud, and Fast Twitch Media can take you there. Be your best digital self. Check out fasttwitchmedia.space.